home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Garrett Miller is out and about in the world, as he is wont to do these days, being a very successful recording artist and actor and all sorts of good things. So tonight, I have a very exciting guest. I'm waiting for her to call in, so we're hoping she will call in, because this woman is incredible, and I'm really excited to talk to her. Her name is Donna Kaz. And one of her names is Donna Kaz, and we'll explain that later. But she has written a book called Unmasked, Memoirs of a Gorilla Girl on Tour. And plus she has done playwriting and all sorts of other work. But the memoir is quite an intense and interesting story, and I'm looking forward to talking to her about it. Donna will also be on my show out in Santa Cruz on Saturday. You can listen to that live streaming on KSCO.com. That is Saturday at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. So please feel free to tune in. The shows are different. And if Donna doesn't end up coming on tonight, they will be very, very different. One will actually have her on it. So I'm hoping she still is calling in tonight. While we are waiting, I wanted to read a poem that Donna wrote, and this will set up some of her story. It's called My Assailant. It's a poem by Donna Kaz. Lives in Europe with two daughters. His three sons left behind their own memories, his open hand, his open mouth, his tears. Has a French girlfriend. Is wealthy, is sober, passes by expensive wine shops without even a sniff of regret, reads the newspaper in another language, meets a few friends in a small cafe, speaks with passion of his dreams, sleeps in a tiny bed of wrought iron on a hard mattress peacefully, but not for very long, takes long walks along some river, no longer recognized by passerbys, his chiseled face framed by the turned-up collar of his starched white Oxford, his receding hairline invisible under a brown leather cap, his eyes squinting at the sun, is captured one day in the background of an international news program on TV, buying cheese and meat from a street vendor, while the foreign correspondent speaks of a terrorist attack, a bombing. And that is a poem that will have a lot more relevance when we talk to Donna about her story. While we're waiting for her, let's talk about Donald Trump. Speaking of abusers. So we are only a week and a half into this presidency, and already the country is fragmented, turned upside down. Our values are all over the place. We are both being threatened and under fear, paranoia. That's a week and a half, folks. We have a leader who's embarrassing. He gets on the phone and berates our allies. He's taken new levels of being a bully. Against the world. Anyway, that is what's going on. The thing that has broken, though, that has extreme relevance to the LGBT community, is the leak of a memo from Donald Trump, or from Donald Trump's staff, to be more accurate, about that threatens to roll out protections for LGBT discrimination. That is, protects people who want to discriminate against us. It is unclear whether Donald Trump himself is anxious to roll this out or whether this is being put forth by his staff, because the memo was leaked. which is an odd thing. It's out there. People are freaking out about it, rightly so. And yet the White House has said that they have no plans to do these executive orders that are indicated there at this time, which seems, you know, Donald Trump tends to do things when he wants to do them and if he wants to do them. So there's sort of an indication that he may be the roadblock. And, you know, his gay supporters and gay friendly supporters are declaring that to be the case, that he is the most gay friendly Republican president in history, which, you know, some of the things he said, there is merit to that claim. However, this set of executive orders would completely reverse that. And, you know, he would go from being potentially one of the best to being one of the worst. So we'll see where that goes. You know, that's where that's at. It's sitting there. Today he met with a prayer breakfast and made an interesting statement or promise that he was going to get rid of the nuclear agreement, the Johnson nuclear agreement, which would allow churches to have tax-free status. And that, for me personally, that is completely maddening. I have often felt that it should go the other way, that churches in this country have far too much political clout for their tax-free status, and that is not fair. But anyway, enough of Donald Trump. I'm sure he will tinge some of our conversation tonight, but I hope not a lot, because Donna's story is fascinating and interesting all on its own, and I would rather talk about that. So without further ado, Donna, welcome to the program.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you great. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm glad I finally got through.
Yeah, the technology world here is very scary. I admit it.
Yes, I think I was on another show for about 3 seconds, but they quickly shut me down, so that's all right.
Well, I'm glad they brought you over to me, because I've been anxiously waiting for you. So,
good.
Oh my gosh, I don't even know where to start with you. I mean, you are so multifaceted, so talented, and such a body of work out there. It's intriguing. While we were waiting for you, just to let you know, I read your poem, My Assailant.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I just thought that would be an interesting setup for Unmasked and your story there. But let's backtrack on, you know, give us a little bit of framework of your whole body of work and where you got started. You've written for theater, you have a screenplay, you've written this memoir. What started you on writing in general?
Well, I've always been a person who kept a diary. Since I was about 12 years old, I've always been drawn to writing down my feelings and getting a lot of satisfaction out of that, not necessarily thinking that I would ever publish anything. But when I got to college, I enrolled in SUNY Brockport, which is a New York State school, to study theater. And my goal was to be an actress and possibly also work a little bit in directing. I graduated. I moved to New York City with dreams of portraying wonderful, interesting women on the stage. And when I got to New York, I found, one, that the roles that were being offered to me were very stereotypical. Young actress is either, oversexed bimbo or, the scullery maid. And I was very disappointed in the kinds of things that were happening in commercial theater. So I was drawn quickly to experimental theater, where for me in the late 70s, early 80s, there were a lot more interesting things happening. And that's where I really started to write out of frustration as an actress who wasn't sort of reading plays that I could envision myself in or that were interesting, that I thought the roles were interesting enough to play. So I started to write plays, basically for myself to perform, but then it quickly moved into pulling out of the role as actress and sort of just taking the reins as a writer and a playwright.
Right. Yeah, I have to say I relate to that a lot. I actually studied theater. My goal was to be an actor, so very similar, you know, background there. I also fell into playwriting, and I always relate to artists who go that direction. And I don't know what it is. I think it's something about theater, the stage, that kind of that bare space that you have to create a story, character, and everything within the confines of those walls that to me seems to be like the height of artistic dramatic expression. I mean, screenwriting, fine, but you know, you don't have those restraints. You can go, you know, to other universes if you want. You know, but with the theater, you have to create it in that space. And if you take people away from that space, you have to do it through your words and your imagination, not because you get to actually film somewhere else. I don't know if that makes
right.
any sense. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, speaking of theater, I want to jump to this because this is rated LGBT radio and this ties in so directly.
Right.
Can you tell me about your screenplay, The King?
Oh, King Me.
King Me,
it's
I'm
called.
Sorry.
It's, and this is another sort of, you know, when I go to the theater, especially the past 30 years or so, there has been a great change in theater and in people's thinking about theater, especially in relation to gender parity and the kinds of people the kinds of narratives, the kinds of stories that are told on stage. I also write musical theater. I love musical theater. One of my favorite film to musicals was La Cage aux Folles, and I really loved the way that, you know, the musical theater world, you know, it was recreated as a musical for
right.
the stage.
Right.
You know, I've been intrigued sort of by, you know, so in looking at that musical, I started to think about, you know, drag queens, but also drag kings. Where are the stories of the drag kings? And wouldn't that, you know, shouldn't that, that's sort of an interesting area to explore. And I started to do a little research about it and see some, you know, films and documentaries. You know, suddenly everybody within the past 5 years, thankfully, has become more aware of transgender rights.
Right.
I had this musical that I had written that it took me years and years and years to sort of figure out, and it wasn't kind of working correctly. And I realized that what I was writing about was about a female-to-male transgender narrative of this this performer in Las Vegas who is going through a change from female to male gender and really identifies as a male and sees himself as a male. And, you know, in the 50s, this particular screenplay takes place in the 50s, and how difficult that was, and sort of that narrative of that struggle. And that sort of worked. It was, you know, I always write about identity. Sort of my theme is always about who am I? How does the world perceive me? What am I really feeling? What am I really trying to say? So all of my work really does deal with the theme of identity. And so I figured out that this was about identity, about the identity of I am a man and I am living as a man and I feel like a man. It just sort of clicked and happened and fell into place.
It sounds absolutely fascinating and timely, and, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I've learned so much just reading the different pieces around your work in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, gender limitations and we'll get into this in a few minutes about just the art world and women and, you know, mm-hmm. I'm aware of the disparity of women representation in a lot of areas. And it wasn't mm-hmm. until I was reading, I should have been aware of it, but as soon as I was reading, you know, your work, it was like, whoa, yeah, this is outrageous. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. But what is the status with the screenplay? Is it on its way to becoming filmed? What is the status?
Oh, I wish.
No, I want to see it already. I'm ready to buy a ticket.
It's a very interesting piece. I submitted it to a competition called the Boundary Stone Screenwriting Competition, and it placed in that competition. And so I had this sort of award behind it. As far as what's happening with it, I'm really sort of back into it, doing a little bit of rewriting with it, and then I'd like to just send it out and see what people think about it, you know, and see if anyone might be interested.
Well,
and that's sort of how you have to go.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I mean, I think somebody should grab onto it. It sounds fresh, original, timely, and quite frankly, you know, even about, and I've found this with my transgender friends, that I always, every person that I'm close with who's transgender is individually a hero to me, because they teach me about authenticity and finding my true self and not allowing external perceptions to define what I otherwise know to be true. And you know, they have a much more of a strong world struggle to assert mm-hmm. that, which is why they're heroic. I think the struggle itself has a universality that should speak to everybody. And I think with the millennials, I think it's speaking more and more to the general population than it has in the past, which is fantastic. So
great.
I've been dancing around this because I knew we'd get into this. I don't know that we'll ever get off it, because your own story is just absolutely fascinating and such a journey. And I'd like you to take us through it, the story of Unmasked and what you've been through. I mean, it's talk about something that is worthy of being a movie. I mean, I want to buy a ticket to that one too.
About 4 years ago, I started to think about writing a memoir because I became a guerrilla girl in 1997. The Guerrilla Girls are a feminist activist group that started in the mid-80s, and they were a bunch of women artists who were fed up with sexism and discrimination in the art world, and they decided to form a group that would address gender parity in the visual art world. And they did it by, one, they all took the names of dead women artists so that people didn't know who they were. They were all visual artists, so they sort of didn't want to threaten their own careers. And they decided to call themselves the Guerrilla Girls, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A, Guerrilla. They made these very poignant, funny black and white posters that, told the sorry statistics about what was happening in the visual art world. For example, 95% of the paintings in the Met Museum are of nude women, but only, and I can't remember the exact stat, but something like 5% of those paintings were actually painted by women. So the Guerrilla Girls made a poster that said, "Do women have to get naked to get into the Met Museum?"
That was one of the talking points that fascinated me, because you never think about that. And I mean, if you take it off even off of the nude pictures, just the artwork in general, it's like certainly there had to have been throughout history women talented artists, but where is their art?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the problem is that women artists, women composers, women writers are not, number one, if they are in the history books at all, if they're talked about at all, they usually are in the footnotes and in the back pages. You really have to look hard to find the stories of these women. So that's one of the, you know, a lot of people would always say to me, well, aren't there just more male writers than there are female writers, or aren't there just more male artists than there are female artists? And that's really not true. There are just as many women who are working in as artists in the performing art world and the visual art world. The problem is that they're not written about. They don't have these shows in major museums. They're working in the trenches. They're working off Broadway. You know, they're creating art in their own collectives, in their own galleries. And that's what's happening. So these posters were plastered all over Soho, which is in New York City at the time in the 80s, was the heart of the visual art world. A lot of artists lived there. There were a lot of galleries there. And people started to get intrigued. Who are these Gorilla Girls? So the press wanted to interview them. And one of them said, well, let's go out and get some gorilla disguises. So they sent one Gorilla Girl out to get some disguises so they wouldn't show their faces during the interview. And this particular Gorilla Girl was a really bad speller. And she said, oh, I thought you meant gorilla disguises. So she came back with these big rubber gorilla masks. And it sort of worked. It was funny. It was a little threatening, a little scary. It was ironic. So the Gorilla Girls, that's how the Gorilla Girls came to wear gorilla masks in public, take the names of dead women artists, and this was to ensure that the focus would always be on the issue that we were addressing, namely sexism and discrimination in the arts. So I came into the group in the late 90s when the Gorilla Girls were sort of revitalizing the group and trying to get new members and new energy into the group. So they invited artists who were not only visual artists. They invited theater artists like myself and choreographers, filmmakers, dancers, performance artists, things like that. And so I became a Gorilla Girl in 1997, and I led the foray into attacking the theater world, because as a theater artist, I felt the great need for there to be some kind of consciousness raising about the fact that theaters all across the country and all across the world, in fact, were producing season after season of plays by white men, hiring only white male directors, and there was this lack of female narrative on the stage represented by directors and producers and things like that. So we attacked the theater world for, 1997 to 2001, when the Gorilla Girls actually split up into three new separate groups and the Theater Girls became Gorilla Girls on Tour. So I have been doing that for almost 20 years now. And 4 years ago, I just decided to take a look at, how did I end up here? How did I end up wearing a hot, sweaty rubber gorilla mask and running around on stage and talking about sexism and discrimination, and not only that, but also lots of other different women's issues, LGBT rights, reproductive rights, different kinds of things that we would address. And I started to think back about my origins as a feminist, and when did I identify as a feminist, and how did I come to be this staunch radical feminist. And, the experiences in my life, in my young life, really influenced the activist that I am today. Namely, I was sexually assaulted as a college student by a professor in college, one of my acting teachers. And when I first moved to New York to become an actress, within 6 months of being here, I got a job at a restaurant in Greenwich Village, which was right around the corner from, at that time in the late 70s, a very well-known off-Broadway theater company called Circle Repertory Company, and an actor named William Hurt was working there. I met him, and we became involved in a tumultuous relationship that was full of violence. And By the time those experiences were over and I had had a chance to process, which also took me a long, long time to even identify as a survivor of domestic violence and a survivor of sexual assault. It took me many, many years to even come to terms with that. But I think that those experiences really informed who I am today and why I do all this activist work.
Right.
And
right.
So I decided to write this book and to braid those two stories together. So the book really switches back and forth between my young self in my 20s and experiencing domestic violence and myself in my 40s, you know, carrying out these missions, trying to fight for gender parity in the theater world and beyond.
Right. And for people who are listening to the show, the poem, The Assailant, that I read at the beginning of the show now probably has a lot more relevance after you've explained some of that background as to
yeah.
who that poem is actually talking about.
Right.
I wanted to. I've got two very different questions, and I'm trying to decide which one to ask first because I don't want to go into one area too much. But just in terms of current happenings with the new regime that we have leading the country, you know, that we've been under for the very long time of a week and a half. It occurs to me that the Guerrilla Girls, if they went beyond the art world, would be highly relevant in a public forum showing up, you know, in our political arena right now. And I wanted to see if about that.
We always address politics, and we have always talked about every single election. The Guerrilla Girls on Tour made a poster about 10 years ago that said, "Woman is president if women want it." More women vote than men in every presidential election since 1984. And every town that we tour to, we make it a point to research the governor, the senators, how they vote. We always reflect back their reproductive rights report card and things like that. So, yes, we have always been involved in politics. And now more than ever, it's, you know, I wrote this book. So this book, my book came out November 1st. And it was a fabulous day for me, and I did a big book signing and reading in Brooklyn, and the energy was very high, and then November 8th happened.
Oh, my God.
And the next time I did a book signing was at Blue Stockings, which is the big feminist bookstore in Manhattan, and it was November 10th, and everyone was depressed and crying and in despair.
Right.
In despair. And actually, you know, in writing this book, I sort of explain how the Guerrilla Girls and how I as a Guerrilla Girl got work done. People had this concept because of the anonymity and the masks that we were this group of thousands of women doing all this, you know, we were accomplishing a lot of things because we were this huge group. And in actuality, we were a very small group who worked in small, we were a small amount of women who worked focused in small groups, and that's how we were able to get a lot of work done.
Right.
And so
on
November 1st, I thought I was going to maybe hang up my mask and pass the torch on, and then Trump gets elected, and no rest for the activists. And now the inspiring thing is, number one, yes, of course, I cried and you know, got violently sick and wanted it all to be a bad nightmare, but that didn't happen. But then after about a week after the election, I just started saying to people, we got this. We got this. We have
right.
to fight. Artists are the truth tellers, and we are if we continue to tell the truth and make art that reflects the truth, there is no way that a liar who we have as a president is going to survive. And so
right.
Here's what I wanted to suggest yeah.
for Guerrilla Girls, because when I was reading your work and reading about the Guerrilla Girls and everything else, I had this vision that every time that Donald Trump speaks, that within the audience is a contingency of guerrilla people. You know, guerrilla girls,
yeah.
you know, guerrilla people in guerrilla costume, guerrilla masks to represent the others, you know, that he's
right.
making the others, you know, them,
right.
the people outside the wall, the people outside the airports, the people that we want to be afraid of, that we don't know, that are, we put behind these masks. As I just would love to see that visual focal point in every audience facing him, for the next 4 years.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it inspires to me. I hear you so loud and clear, because I'm the same way. I mean, my writing is commentary and activism, and it's like, and you're right. It's like, as we were skating into, okay, Hillary's going to take over the next 4 years. Obama got us started. She'll get us further. And boy, we can just hang up the activism, things. And,
right.
We can tinker on the outstanding issues, but here we go. And now it's being dialed back, and it's like, we've been through it before. We know how to do this. We know how to do this. And so I totally get you. It's very, you're very inspiring to me. I'm like head over heels. But I want to go back to your story though, because it is so fascinating and deep and personal. So you found yourself in this relationship, and you ended up in LA. And can you tell us what happened from there?
I was in this violent relationship for 3 years. Technically, we were together for 3 years, but we remained, even after we broke up, we remained together on and off for about 10 years after that. And in 1986, I was working for a film production company who offered me a job in their West Coast LA branch. And I took the job because nothing was really happening for me in New York, so I moved to Los Angeles. And I worked in the film business in a lot of different capacities for many years. I was an assistant director, and I was in development, and it was extremely draining and not very soul-fulfilling. I write about a incident that happened to me where I was working on this television pilot, and the leading character was supposed to be a female from outer space who had dropped to Earth and ran into somebody's garage, got some clothes, and put the clothes on, and then ran out. And so, of course, the costume designer put her in, T-shirts and some old jeans that she found, and the producer came up and said, no, we want her to wear a black leather cat suit. And it was incidents like that where it's like, are you kidding? Let's just have all women be, these objects instead of these real people.
Right.
And that's sort of how it was. It was a very male-oriented, and probably still is, very male-oriented industry, very chauvinistic. So I'm sitting in my apartment one day, and I'm thinking, I really have to do something. There's got to be people in L.A. who aren't working in the film business and who are doing great social things. And I just thought, wow, you know what? Maybe I should volunteer for the L.A. Rape and Battery Hotline. This just popped into my head for no reason, and I called them up. They sent me an application. The training was quite intense, and it was a 3-month training program, and the first day that I went to the offices of the L.A., at that time it was called the L.A. Commission on Assaults Against Women. Now the organization, it's a great organization, it's called Peace Over Violence in Los Angeles. At the very first training session, everyone had to go around and introduce themselves, and people were standing up, women were standing up saying, my name is Shirley, I'm a survivor. My name is Carol, I'm a survivor. My name is, Diane, I'm a survivor of domestic violence or a survivor of rape. And it hit me, that's when it hit me for the first time, survivor, oh my goodness, I am a survivor too. And really, I wrote a piece for Ms. Magazine blog about this called The Process of Disclosure. I hate it when people say, accuse a rape survivor or a sexual assault survivor who comes forward on television, as all those women did against Trump and talked about him being a sexual predator. The first thing people think is, well, why is she bringing it up now? Why did she bring it up 14 years later, 10 years later, 5 years later? And that's because it takes time to process violence that has happened to you. And sometimes women process it quickly, and sometimes they process it slowly, and sometimes they never process it at all. And we must respect everyone's timeline and
right.
everyone's ability to process trauma.
Well, plus
and
it,
so
is,
that
it is
was,
inconceivable that somebody would sit and just conjure up, if they're going to imagine something fanciful that happened in their lives,
right.
the trauma would not be it. I mean, it's...
No, no.
You know, it,
and
there's
also
no other
the other
trauma.
Thing is that, you know, when you experience trauma, what do you do first? Do you jump up and tell the world about it?
No, it's
you know?
Shameful.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you feel ashamed, you feel confused, you try to downplay it, you try to, you know, I was saying to myself, oh, I only went to the emergency room once. That means that I was not really beaten up, you know.
Right.
I never really had bruises on my face, you know. So this was 14 years later. 14 years later, some gut instinct took me to the training for the LA Rape and Battery Hotline, and that was 14 years after the experience had happened to me, and I was finally admitting to myself that I had survived.
Right. And the poem that I read at the beginning of the show sort of was, I think it was one of your first expressions of that, wasn't it? Or did that
right.
come later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
so,
no, it was one of the first, yeah.
Something happened with the O.J. Simpson case or event that got through
right.
to you in LA. How did that impact you?
Well, then I worked on the LA Rape and Battery Hotline for a year, and then I really got into the domestic violence movement and the movement to end violence against women. I became a volunteer court advocate in the court system, the LA County court system. I worked in a battered women's shelter for a time. Of course, I was working on the hotline. And the people, Patty Giggins, who is the executive director of Peace Over Violence, they asked me to become a speaker on their speakers bureau to talk about my experience of surviving domestic violence. They knew my story. At that time, they were the only people who really knew my story, who knew the full story and who knew who my batterer was. So I was working in that movement when O.J. Simpson was accused of killing Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. Patty Giggins called me up and said, you know, the press needs someone who's a survivor of domestic violence to sort of speak about what that experience is like. And because your batterer was a high-profile batterer, I think you might be the right person to speak about your experience and what you went through, but you don't have to say any names, and you don't even have to do it if you don't want to do it. But I was doing a play in L.A. at the time. I had written a play for myself, and I was performing it at a theater called the Woodenough Theater, which was right under the 405 freeway. And the night that O.J. Simpson led his Bronco chase down the highway was a night that I was going to be performing, and my entire audience was outside watching this Bronco chase when they should have been at 5 minutes to eight. The show curtain was supposed to go up at 8 o'clock, and the whole audience is intrigued by this Bronco chase. And I was really angry that this guy who was accused of murdering his wife and his friend, had beaten her up. This batterer was getting more attention than I was getting in my little play. So it really affected me. And when Patty Giggins asked me to speak as a survivor of domestic violence, I said yes. And I knew that I was going to be going on a lot of – I was on CNN. I was on, you know, several different talk shows and things like that. And I knew that once I came out and I stood up in front of the world, basically, and said that I had survived, that I would never see or hear from William Hurt again. And that's exactly what happened.
That was you were in contact with him prior to that, and then that was then that that
I
was
had
the reaction.
In contact
was
with
out.
Him on and off in sort of this attempt to maintain this friendship with him. you know, in my heart, it was very difficult to cut loose from him. It was a very addictive relationship. Most violent relationships are very addictive, and it's almost like a drug, you know, that you cannot quite get out of. And it was like that for me. And going through the whole experience of working in the domestic violence movement helped me to cut that tie. But that was sort of the symbolic end in my head, that now I was going to talk about it and people were going to see me on television, and he would probably see me, and that would be it.
Before he cut you out, did he have any response to you, going public? I mean, confrontational response?
No, we never talked about anything like that. In fact, I would never even think about it at that time. I mean, I just did it. And when I did it, that's sort of the stand, taking the stand of, you're out of my life. This happened to me. It was bad, and it was wrong, and it's not my fault, and now I'm going to tell the story. And that's the impetus for me to also write the book, was this story might help somebody. My story is probably a common one for women, and perhaps it might help somebody. I even talk about this in the book. I took out a pad, and I wrote down all the advantages of telling my story, what might happen, and I filled up a page, and then on the other side I wrote all the advantages of not telling my story, and that piece of paper is still blank.
Yeah, no, that was going to be my next question. What now? And actually, let's address it in this environment where you have, let's face it, the whole revelation of Trump's recording about, you know, grabbing women, and that, just apart from the crassness of it, the conversation itself sort of speaks to what you were talking about in terms of the perception of women in the arts, in television, in film. I mean, that conversation could have even happened where it was given a sense of normalcy. And then we elect this person leader of the free world. What message does that send to women? And for women who are dealing with abuse, what is your advice to them?
I would say you really have to practice self-care and be good to yourself. I know a lot of women are quite frightened and are quite, you know, like are quite amazed that this happened, can't understand how it could happen. I think we have to be good to each other, be kind to one another, and we have to believe the women, we have to trust women, we have to trust black women, we have to become involved in all of the different movements that are supporting women's rights, and not only women's rights, but Muslim rights and LGBT rights and Black Lives Matter and all of that. We have to reach across the aisles where we can get some support and comfort. I just have to keep reminding everyone that, you know, and tell the truth. Tell the truth, believe women when they tell their story.
Right. So going back to Unmasked, so you had this revelation, you came out, you know, of who you were. I mean, it was really a coming out story. During that OJ time, where did that take you? How did that take you into activism, and what were further things that inspired you?
Well, I think I really started to look at myself and my art and my activism as combined and not really separated. I had been writing plays about women's narrative and women's stories. I wrote a whole play about Joan of Arc as somebody who had a quest and a vision and went after it. You know, I wrote King Me. I wrote another musical. My work always deals with identity, but deals with woman's identity. And I just felt that I was an activist artist, that those two words were not separate. And so I left L.A. In 1993 and moved back to New York City to become involved in the theater world. That was my true sort of first love, and I felt like I was coming back here. And when I came back to New York City, I just noticed that there was all this discrimination still going on, and all these theater companies were producing plays by white men, and there was not a lot of inclusivity and not a lot of diversity. And you know, it was a question of who has the seat at the table, and it was definitely not women.
Right.
It was definitely not writers of color. It was definitely not gay and lesbian writers. It was, you know, it just seemed to be, you know, straight white men whose stories were being put out there. And I coincidentally met a woman who was a visual artist and at an artist colony called Jurassic, which is in California. And I started to talk to her about the, you know, how horrible it was for women in theater. And she said, yes, it's really horrible for women in the visual art world, too. And she gave me a book. She said, read this book. And it was Confessions of the Guerrilla Girls. And it was all the Guerrilla Girls' original first posters. And I thought, this is great. This is a great idea. This is how we might attack discrimination in the theater world. We can make plays and we can make posters that are all about sexism in theater. And when I saw her the next day after I read the book, I said, you have to get me in touch. Do you happen to know any Guerrilla Girls? I really need to get in touch with them. I really need to see if they might be able to attack the theater world. And she said, well, you know, actually, I am a Guerrilla Girl. So I just happened to meet a Guerrilla Girl, and she said, we're taking on new members, and I think you'd make a great Guerrilla Girl. Would you be interested in joining the group? And, of course, I said yes, and the rest is history. And then I was able to really focus on getting everyone's mind to think about how sexist and how discriminatory the theater world actually was. Because everyone thinks the arts are really liberal. I mean, there's all these liberal people in the art world and in the theater world, and the arts are very welcoming and inclusive, and that's actually not the case. And so,
yeah, I think it comes down to, in certain environments where there is some women representation and some women are visible, that
right,
and we as a society look at that and go, oh, okay, oh, that's inclusive. Okay, you know, we have,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
we accept tokenism for inclusivity, and
right,
it's not.
Right.
I actually was surprised. Somebody was talking to Ruth Bader Ginsburg and said, you know, what would be a fair amount of women on the Supreme Court? And I was surprised by her answer at first, and then I realized, no, it made total sense. Her answer was 9. That would be a fair amount, because, you know, how many years in the history of the Supreme Court was it all men?
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
And I've even mentioned that to people, and when you know, I said 9, and they went, 9? Oh, that's, oh, no. It's like, hey, you know. It's you're
no,
talking
some
about
theater, and then when you have a theater company, there was a couple of theater companies who produced, you know, they just switched over and they realized the error of their ways, so they did seasons of all plays by women. That's fantastic. Make up for lost time. People accuse us of being quota queens. We were calling for 50% representation by women, but, you know, I'll take 100 just to
know,
make up for the fact that, you know, it's been all men for years.
Well, it is reflective, and maybe it should be the leadership role. Maybe we should focus this in on the arts, because you look at business, you know, across the board, you know, certainly you look in government, you can see how completely oriented towards men, especially now, it is. And but the hidden part is, if you look at the Fortune 500 companies, incredibly low percentage of that leadership is women. I mean, it makes the government look positively progressive. I mean, by comparison. So, you know, we have these things in society, but they're just not looked at. So, Donna, so you discovered the Guerrilla Girls. Where do you take that in the book? Because obviously the book's called Unmasked, so you get to a point where you're unmasking.
Yes, I worked tirelessly with the Guerrilla Girls and with Guerrilla Girls on tour addressing not only discrimination in the performing art world, but beyond and other things. And we saw very little progress. We saw very little people, a very small amount of people who even wanted to discuss the issue in the late 90s and early in 2000, 2001. And it was very discouraging at first because, I thought, oh, I'm just going to tell people how sexist theater is and it'll change. Audiences will be refusing to buy tickets, you know, and producers would say, oh, my goodness, I can't believe I've done this. How stupid of me. Let me produce women. But it happened slowly. Well, now, today, I am happy to report there are many, many groups, not only Guerrilla Girls on Tour, addressing sexism in theater. And there have been support groups and advocacy groups. The LA Female Playwrights Initiative, for example. 50-50 in 2020 is an initiative of the League of Professional Theater Women, calling for representation of 50% women in theater by the year 2020. There's the Dramatists Guild Women's Committee. There's Little Black Dress, Inc. There's the Kilroys, which put out a list every year of the best plays by women for producers to produce. So there's a lot of organizations addressing this now. Most theater companies do not get away with the token play by a woman or an artist of color, just one in the season. We still have to keep on a whole bunch of theater companies that still produce only plays by men. But there has been some progress. And so I thought that it would really be worth it to, like I said earlier in the program, to tell people how we did this. What steps did we use? What tactics did we use? How did we get the message out? And it's really a question of, and a lot of this is going around now, how do you formulate, how do you affect change? You know, meet in small groups. Gather your ideas. Share your ideas. You know, I learned a very important thing from the Op-Ed Project here in New York, which is a project trying to get more women and people of color's voices into the opinion pages. And it's an idea developed slowly if kept inside one mind. So you have an idea. You meet in small groups. You share these ideas. And then you come up with strategies. And you have goals, you have an agenda, and you make this a very doable agenda, calling your members of Congress or going to a protest or making a poster or making a piece of theater. And so I thought it was important for me to share all of that information and to unmask and to say, you know, I used to say, you know, it's kind of pathetic. I have to wear this hot, sweaty rubber gorilla mask. And take the name of a dead woman artist, take the name of Afra Ben, and go around to make anyone pay any attention to sexism in theater. And so I still identify as Afra Ben, and I still wear my rubber gorilla mask, but I'm going to share the story because perhaps others will be inspired by it and will be able to pull on some of the ideas that and some of the actions that I did to form their own groups.
Right. Now, you attended the Women's March, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. What was
that
experience like?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I've been, you know, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s. I went to my first protest in the early 1971. I just enjoy the whole performative nature of getting together with like-minded people and chanting and marching and letting our voice be heard. The Women's March was absolutely inspiring and it's so uplifting and empowering to see men and women and babies and old people and young people and people of color and just everyone was there and we were all together and we all had the same focus. The other thing was is that it was a lot of fun. You know, people forget that you have to have a sense of humor in all this. Yes, it is totally depressing, and you feel like you cannot even keep up with what Trump is doing. But believe me, that's his tactic. You know, his tactic is to sort of get your attention over here and then get your attention over there and make you all confused. Yeah, so we have to remember that we have to keep getting together, we have to keep protesting, and we have to keep having fun and enjoying the small, you know, wins. Like that day was really a win. That day was really a win for the world.
Is there a positive of us being the underdog now? Is it sort of like strengthening a muscle that we kind of needed to do?
Absolutely. It's the end of apathy. And that's a good thing. Because, believe me, in the last 20 years of doing this work as a guerrilla girl, I would go to college campuses, and the 25 feminists on campus who were organizing would sit in the front row, and everyone else behind them would be on their computers, you know, doing something else. And I think that people are really saying, well, I can't, it's no longer enough for me to go online and sign a petition. I've got to do much more than that, because this is much bigger. And so, yes, in that way, people have woken up and people have gotten together and people are forming groups. That's good.
Right.
I mean, unfortunately, it's against this, you know, this crazy person.
Insanity. No, it was unthinkable. But I really do feel like there are things that we are addressing that were underlying issues before, that we were just kind of lopping over and whitewashing on top of, pardon the expression.
Right.
And now we're having to dig deeper. We're having to, you know, peel back the onion and address it. So Donna, here's the shock of the interview. We only have about 3 minutes left of our hour.
Time went so fast.
I know. I hope the, time flies when you're having fun, sticks on this.
Right.
The good news is you and I aren't done. I get to interview you again Saturday on Out in Santa Cruz. So for our listeners listening on, if they listen to www.ksco.com, they can hear it live stream. That's Saturday, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. And tell us more on where people can get the book Unmasked and find out about your other work.
Well, I have two websites, DonnaKaz.com and also GorillaGirlsOnTour.com or GGOnTour.com. You know, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, all that stuff. You can get the book anywhere, online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can go to the library and request it. It's also in e-form. But basically, if you just search for Unmasked, Memoirs of a Guerrilla Girl on Tour by Donna Kaz, a.k.a. Afra Ben, you'll be able to find it.
Yeah, it's fascinating work. I only got scratched the surface of all the things I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to talk about the motivation behind Joan and what you did with her and that work and all that stuff. So, you know, we'll have to agree that we have more conversations. And I really do think the Guerrilla Girls being at every Trump event would be just the most fantastic cultural thing that could happen.
Well, there is a mask in the back of my book that you can rip out and cut out and wear. So people can do that as an action.
Maybe I'll start it. I'll show up there with, I'll be a gorilla boy. So
good.
In our last minute, they'll give you the last word. What do you want people to take away from your inspiration?
Well, I hope that people find their own voice and search for their own voice and express it in whatever way that they that makes them feel right and correct and good. I don't advocate that everyone needs to tell their story, because I think, as I said before, everyone comes to their own story through a process, and it's absolutely fine if you want to keep it inside. I would just say let's all reach out to each other in this trying times and try to support each other.
Perfect. I am so glad we have another interview, because I just want more, and I'm glad we have more coming. So that's
well,
my selfish
comment.
Well,
me too. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Thank you so much, Donna. Thanks for joining, and thank you for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back next week. I'm Rob Watson. My absent co-host is Garrett Miller, and we will get his twinkle toe voice on as well. Stay well, folks, and see you then.